Good morning. Hope your Monday is off to a great start so far this morning. 10:06 is the time right now. Hi there, and welcome to the second hour of our show. I'm Rick Howe with you until 12:30 this afternoon. And here's what's ahead on the show for you today. Time now for another edition of Science Files. And Dr. Rob is back with us this morning. I'll make the introduction in just a moment. After the news at 11, it's your turn to sound off today. We're going to the phones next hour for Manic Monday. It's our first open hour of the week. And, of course, as always, anything goes. And after the news at noon, there's a public meeting tonight to hear residents' concerns about a potential influx of houseboats in the Portage Lake area. Councillor David Hensby will be there, and he'll join me with more this afternoon. And we'll hear another Halifax history moment with historian and author Blair Bead. But this hour, let's talk science. And joining me in the studio this morning for our first edition of Science Files here in 2020 is St. Mary's University astrophysicist Dr. Rob Thacker. Good morning, Dr. Rob, and Happy New Year to you.
Good morning and Happy New Year. And I promise not to make any 2020 vision jokes.
Okay.
Sorry, that was going around on Twitter as like all sorts of 2020 jokes.
All right. I've got an interesting story to start things off here this morning. Perhaps you might not find it as interesting as I have, but I'm reading here about the first British astronaut. It's a lady by the name of Helen Sharman.
Yeah, that's quite a few years ago.
Yeah.
She went to Mir.
She went to Mir in 1991, in fact. Yeah. And she told The Observer the other day, this is a British newspaper, she says, quote, "There are so many billion stars out there in the universe that there must be all sorts of different forms of life. Will they be like you and me, made up of carbon and nitrogen? Maybe not." But she went on to say that it is possible that they're here right now with us. And that we simply can't see them. This is from a British astronaut.
I knew you had to have something to spring on me. You had 2 weeks of looking at headlines to find that. Okay. Well, sure. I mean, we've had this conversation before.
Yes, like, we have.
If they are so advanced that they can come here, their technology or the level of technology that they have access to should be absolutely spectacular. Right. And so would we know that they were there? I'm not necessarily saying they'd be invisible or something like that. Would they be able to take different forms? I think that's a bit of a stretch scientifically. But, you know, I don't honestly agree with the statement that they'll probably could be in different forms of life. I think most life in the universe probably is going to be carbon based because carbon chemistry is so incredibly unique.
Yeah.
Right. That kind of makes carbon stand out as the element in the universe that you're going to build sophisticated life forms from. But yeah, I know. I've kind of haven't we had this conversation before?
We've had several of these conversations.
Yeah, I know. So I kind of have some sympathy for the concept that if they're here, we probably wouldn't know it. I think that's probably not such a crazy idea in and of itself, but I still come back to the likelihood of them actually being here being very low as well.
Yeah, she says aliens exist. There's no two ways about it. But she also had something interesting to say as
well. Yeah, well, I would agree with that as well. Yeah. I mean, we know that life on the Earth was here really quickly. Okay, it was just single-cell bacteria, but that was really quick. It was a few hundred million years after the Earth formed, a few hundred million years after the Sun formed. So that's probably happened somewhere else. The hard thing is how we get really sophisticated species, how we get the so-called eukaryotic cell, which allows you to have all sorts of diversification. That seems to be the really difficult thing.
Mm. She does say as well that there's, in her words here, quote, "no greater beauty than looking at the Earth from up high." And that to me would be on my bucket list. If it was possible for me to go up there and look down on the Earth, I think that would be absolutely fantastic.
I think that would be too. And so, I mean, that shot, the blue marble image, is like the sigil of the environmental movement. So, yes, I would completely agree with that.
Yep, indeed. 10:10 is the time here right now. Mm. Let's talk about what's going on in Australia right now Dr. Rob.
Yeah. Wow.
These devastating wildfires. And here, the toll, I mean, there's been a human toll. About 20 people have been killed so far and thousands of homes destroyed. But it's estimated that 500 million animals, or if not more, koala bears, kangaroos, and marsupials and that may have been lost and may have even driven some species extinct.
Yeah, no, it's devastating. And in fact, I read a lot of different news websites for this. So I was looking at the UK and they aggregated the amount of area in Australia that's actually on fire.
Yeah. And?
And it was basically half of the southern UK.
Wow. Yeah.
Right. And so it's a stunning amount of area that's on fire. And literally, in many cases, there's no way for things to escape this, right? Because the spread of the fire, if you actually generate significant winds around it because you've got a big enough fire going on, it's faster than you can run.
Yeah.
Right? So you can't even outrun it. And so it's no wonder so many animals are being caught. But the thing, from a scientific perspective, I thought the thing that would be good for us to talk about is how these actually form their own weather systems.
Yeah.
Right.
And fire tornadoes and tornadoes.
Fire tornadoes, there's a lot of debate about fire tornadoes because you can have little whirls that start on the ground, little whirlwinds that start on the ground. And those are fairly well known with actual fire systems. That just tends to happen as they contract. They spin up and so on, and they sort of dissipate fairly quickly. But there are reports in Australia that there was actually something that came down from a cloud and then got caught in a fire, and that would be a proper tornado.
Like a lightning strike of some sort.
No, it was literally a tornado that came down onto the fire then just got really, really hot and was just moving around and creating scorches everywhere. They're saying that that actually ended up killing someone who was trying to put the fire out.
Really?
And so the amazing thing is that, as we talked about, I think on the last Science Files, actually, how clouds form. And so when you have a fire going on, you've got all of this warm air rising, pulling in other warm, moist air as well, lifting that up. And, of course, as you lift it up, you've got the same kind of situation that you have when you form a thundercloud, right? You've got air, warm air rising up, transferring electrical charge into different parts of the cloud and creating the situation where you can have a lightning strike. And of course, if you've got lightning and you've got a lot of dry material that's ready to go, you just keep on spreading the fire.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's why these weather systems can be so potentially devastating, because even though there is some rain, you've now got electrical charges getting things going on top of what's already happening on the ground.
They're calling these pyrocumulonimbus clouds.
Pyrocumulonimbus. So cumulonimbus are thunderclouds, and pyro means created by fire. So there we go.
Yeah, and I saw some video of these fire natals. You know, that kind of just shoot up from the ground. And
yeah, so those really are whirlwinds. If you see them going from the ground, those are the whirlwinds.
Okay? Yeah. And the embers that are being spread by the winds, I mean, that's part of the reason why these fires just keep getting bigger and bigger and harder to control, is that the winds have complicated. Not only are the winds fanning the existing flames, but they're carrying the embers great distances.
That's exactly it. And so I learned from fires that happen in Canada that you might think a river would be enough to stop something, but because of the wind you've just mentioned, and in fact, I've even seen footage of wind literally picking up a branch that was on fire, carrying it over a river, and then dropping it on the other side, and a fire starting on the other side.
Amazing,
right?
And if you, if you've seen the video, sure. And again, some of these fire crews driving through these firestorms. I mean, it's absolutely amazing that the death toll hasn't been much, much higher.
Well, I mean, to give credit to the emergency systems over there, they are at least making people aware of when they've got to get somewhere to get away from the fire. And so, I think the word is out. People are obviously very, very concerned about this for completely understandable reasons. This is very serious. In fact, my elder sister lives in Australia, and she's been so devastated by it, she didn't even want to talk about it when I called her to talk about it. So this is a huge thing, and there is an amazing amount of area. I would say, of course, that bushfires are part of the ecosystem there, but this is just unprecedented.
Temperatures in excess of 40 degrees consistently.
Well, they've had a series of droughts, and now there's this dipole oscillation in the temperature in the Indian Ocean that's actually making Western Australia slightly cooler than normal. They've had really quite cooler temperatures over the Christmas period. Normally, you would expect Perth to be in the mid-30s. They were down at 23. Mm. And, of course, the other side of the country is just dry as a bone.
Yeah. And there's a discussion, a debate, however you want to describe it right now, about climate change. And is this the result of climate change? And just leave that thought in your head for a moment to Dr. Rob. We'll talk about that when we come back. It is 10:15 right now. This is Science Files with Dr. Rob Thacker from St. Mary's University. And if you've got a comment or a question, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We're back with more with Dr. Rob right after this quick break. 10:18 our time. We've got a number of email questions coming in here. We'll get to those in a moment. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. The question that being debated right now in Australia is, has this got to do with climate change? And We talked during the break, and we know that Scott Morrison, who's Australia's prime minister, has been, I won't call him a climate change denier, but has been kind of dragging his feet. He's from the coal and gas industry in Australia. And I just wonder, you know, has his attitude toward climate change perhaps been a contributing factor to what's going
on
in Australia?
Well, I mean, his attitude could be an even more significant issue down the road. I mean, he's one of the people who's a big proponent of creating this massive open pit coal mine, would be one of the biggest in the world. It's very difficult to point a finger and say that this is one person's responsibility. But at the same time, you would like to see him turn around and say to the people, yeah, there's an issue here. Because scientists generally seem to agree that this significant number of years of drought that Australia has been facing is a product of the changing climate, right? There doesn't seem to be a huge disagreement. 1 year is always difficult to pin down, but nonetheless, there's more and more evidence that this is actually all about climate change. And so not really being prepared to acknowledge that and say, oh, we're going to plow on with these really big projects that are going to release tons of carbon, right? Mm. So that's not going to make you very popular with the people who are living in the middle of these wildfires because of the fact there's been a drought for several years. So it's not, I saw footage of him going to a small village.
I saw that too.
Yeah. And well, he was prepared to do it, but he really didn't get a warm welcome at all. And so when everyone around the world, well, everyone, when lots and lots, the majority of people around the world are saying, look, this is an issue that we have to address for younger generations as well as ourselves, it's kind of sad to see someone saying, well, no, we're just going to plow on as we were before, right? I mean, I don't fully understand why he would want to do that other than the economic factors, of course. But at the same time, I don't see how you can... It's kind of like you're stealing from a future generation.
Truly, truly.
Right?
You know, we think things are bad right now. They've still got 2 months of their summer weather left here in Australia. Mm-hmm. I mean, things could get even worse between now and when their summer comes to an end.
Yeah, I mean, these fires are so large, they're essentially out of control in most of the states there. So, I mean, you're just going to have to wait for rain to blow them out. And that's all there is to it.
Pretty much. Let's go back to the phones. And Don's on the line with a question or a comment this morning. Hi, Don.
Good morning, gentlemen.
How are you today?
Not too bad. Nice show again, Rick, with him, I'll tell you. Here's the question. Okay, you heard of the insulation foam, the stuff about 30 years ago the government approved, and a lot of people got sick in their house about it? You know, that they're in your walls and everything?
I know what you're talking about, yeah. I wasn't aware of people getting sick from it. I do know that the gases that were used to inflate it were contributing to the hole in the ozone layer.
Okay, now here's the question. The new stuff they get out now, would that be kind of different from what they used back then, or would it be similar or not? I'm skeptic about it, but there's people getting in like you wouldn't believe it, in the walls, in the basement, and in your attic too. And it was on Marketplace there on the news to hear it too. Some people here tear the roof off their house, more or less, and take it all out because it was making them sick. They didn't know, it's called building sick syndrome.
Sick building syndrome,
Yes. But now the new stuff out, is it gases and chemicals into that too? Do you know, or can you, you know?
So I don't, off the top of my head, but I do know certainly that there was a switch over in terms of the gases that were used. This is something that is dear to my heart. So if you let me come back and do a little bit of research over a break, I could actually think I can probably get you an answer to this. I haven't heard, ironically, my mum and dad in the UK had cavity wall blown foam insulation put in that, or injected foam insulation put in that many, many years ago. And they've never really had any health issues. But I mean, I'm not saying other people haven't. So, but the main reason that I heard they changed the foams was because concerns over the CFCs that were being used for the gas. But nonetheless, certainly could be possibilities, and I'll look into it over a break and see what I can find.
10:22 is the time, and Brenda called in Matt to pass on a question, and Ken is on the line with a similar question. I'll read Brenda's question. First, she wants to know what's going to happen when the star Betelgeuse explodes. And I think Ken's got a similar question here this morning. Hi, Ken.
Yeah, sure. Harrison Schmitt, the last person to walk on the moon, Apollo 17, was on the media the past few weeks, and Betelgeuse was the sixth most bright star, and in a few months has gone to the 21st. And Schmitt was saying that it could go supernova, but maybe it would be 8,000 years. What would Betelgeuse going supernova do for us?
Okay.
And number two, Rob, I know I'm fast sometimes. Next year will be the most exciting year in space. Elon is going to launch 50 satellites plus the small ones. NASA's going to launch 50 satellites. You are in the most exciting business in the world right now. I think we should realize how things have changed. Space, which was boring with the shuttle, is now amazing. And one last comment: the Mustang, the Ford Mustang. All the commercials were on the football games on the weekend. It'll get 300 miles to one charge. They're taking orders right now. 44,000 American, 7,500 with the government rebate. Wow.
Yeah, indeed.
Game changer.
Yeah. Thanks, Ken. I owned a 64 Mustang once. Bought it for
$300.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, okay.
I would prefer my old Mustang. 64. Did I say 64
stop,
Mustang?
Stop damaging the planet.
Yeah,
so,
what about
Beetlejuice? Let's start with Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
So I've been following this fairly closely, and this has been super frustrating because you talk to the researchers who work on variable stars, right? Stars that get brighter and dimmer and so on. Beetlejuice is known for having this type of oscillation, and everyone is like, oh, it's got a lot dimmer, but actually it's just dimmer than it has within the last 50 years. Could it be the precursor to it actually going supernova because it will get dimmer before it goes supernova? It's really unlikely that that's what's going on right now. It's captured people's imagination because if it did go supernova,
yes,
right, then it would be as bright as the moon.
Okay.
So you'd be able to see a star.
That would be the
whole daytime.
Impact, just be a bright kind of...
Yeah. So you would be able to see it during the daytime if you were in the right place to be able to see it. And so by that, I mean the actual constellation was above the horizon for you. And so that would be an awesome sight. It would be so bright. It would be an awesome sight. The ironic thing is astronomers can be complaining about the Starlink satellites.
Yeah.
If we had something as bright as the moon up, we'd be having a really hard time actually taking a lot of observations.
Really?
Right? Because it would just cast so much light into the sky. So that's kind of funny. But it would eventually die down and go away. So it would be a really neat thing to see for about a year and so on. But the probability of this happening is someone's done the stats on this. And so literally in our lifetimes, it's a 0.1%.
It's not really very likely at all. Yeah,
right?
Really, yeah.
Not very likely. It's 1 in 1,000, basically. So I know everyone's super excited and people have written lots and lots of really cool pieces in the news about what would happen if it did explode. It won't impact us other than being a bright thing in the sky. People are saying, well, what about the big blast shell that comes out? We don't have to worry about that too much. It's far enough away. It wouldn't be significant. The radiation wouldn't be too significant either. That wouldn't be too much of a problem at all. So it'd be a really neat sight. But probably not going to happen, folks. Sorry.
Mm. And don't say Beetlejuice three times.
You can if you want. I don't mind.
But, Ken, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say the follow-up, Ken, saying that how amazing 2020 is going to be.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that after the break.
Absolutely.
Here.
Yeah, we can do that for sure.
We got the top 20 space missions coming up this year, and some very interesting ones indeed. George is on the line. He's got a question for us. George, we'll get to you coming up after a news update. It is 10:27 right now. We're going to take a break for the news update here. And if you've got a question for Dr. Rob on this Monday morning, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. You can also reach us via email, rick.howe@news957.com, or even tweet us a comment or a question on our Twitter handle, @TheRickHowe Show. We're going to break here for a news update. Stay with us. We'll be back right after the news. Ten 10:32 here on this Monday morning. We're into an hour of Science Files here, and with me in the studio is, of course, St. Mary's astrophysicist Dr. Rob Thacker. And if you've got a comment or a question, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Just before we go to George on the phone, Dr. Rob, you've got an answer to, I think it was Don's question about spray foam.
Well, it's not a good answer, but I think it's sort of speaks to the issue here. So there's been a lot of testing of the spray foams that are used by people who are experts on this. And when they test them, they make sure everything is properly mixed. Like you have two basically components that come together to form the spray foam. And there is an acknowledgement that while the foam is being sprayed, that is not a healthy environment. So people are meant to be out of the house when that's being done. And so once the foam is sprayed, it actually attaches to the wall and then it sets. And it takes a few hours to set. And basically, after a 24-hour period, the people who do all of the testing in the lab say that essentially the volatile gases that are said to come off this, they're essentially undetectable after 24 hours.
Yep.
Okay, that's if you've mixed it properly. If you haven't mixed it properly, there are some concerns that the actual release may go on longer than that, and that could be an issue. So in general, what the EPA in the States, Environmental Protection Agency, has said that, you know, the long-term understanding of what could happen for these spray foams if they have not been cured correctly is not fully understood. And so they are currently working with ASTM International on a better understanding of this. But in general, the short answer is, yes, these things have been tested. That as long as you apply them, you are an expert, you know how to mix them properly, they should be pretty darn safe.
Yeah, right? Someone sent me a link to a story. Yeah. It goes back to 2015, a class action lawsuit by homeowners against Retrofoam of Canada Inc. Installers and suppliers of the product and the Canadian government's been settled for $13 million. The lawsuit after Health Canada ordered the company to stop selling the insulation because of the fact that urea formaldehyde foam insulation was part of that.
Well, if you're not using the right thing, exactly. If you're not using the right thing, you get everything that's coming at you. Right? Indeed. Everything that's coming at you.
Yeah. All right, back to the phones. And George on the line here with us this morning. Hi, George.
Good morning, Rick. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing so freaking wonderful. It's not funny.
Oh, that sounds good. What are you on? I want some.
What's your question this morning, George?
Well, just two things, Rick. But first of all, let me tell you about the Joker at the Enfield Legion.
Yes, I bought my tickets on Saturday.
Good man.
$330,000 and change, I believe, is up for grabs, right?
$370,000.
All right. Well, if I win, George, I'll buy you a burger. How about that?
That's a year of your salary, Rick.
So
it has to be a Whopper, though.
No problem. What's your question this morning?
Rob, I have a question. I follow the weather a fair bit. Now that I'm retired or something like that. And I'm watching the sunrise and sunsets on Global Weather Network. That's the one I follow, so that's what I'm referring to. And, Rob, today, January 6th, we gained 1 minute of daylight today, according to the Global Sunrise times that they post out. But we've gained 17 minutes of daylight in the evening time. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Why isn't that the same?
Oh, that's related. Oh, I've got to remember the two of these. Sorry, that's a really good question, and I wish I could just trot it out. Some of my colleagues in the Royal Astronomical Society go, oh, that's because. So it's related to where we are, as far as I remember, it's related to where we are in the specific part of our orbit. Because if you assume everything, if we were on a circular orbit, then everything would be pretty much the same. But because we're on a slightly elliptical orbit, it changes where we get the difference in the daytime. I think that's the answer. I could be wrong.
Okay. Because my biggest thing is, like, I've been watching it, and the latest it set in the evening was 4:32, and it's now up to 4:48. So that's roughly 17 minutes, right? So 16 minutes. But we've only gained 1 minute. Today is the first time we've gained 1 minute in the morning. And we're going to start gaining every day. So that just baffles my mind that it's 17 minutes in the evening of daylight, and we've only gained 1 minute.
Yeah, like I said, I think it's just because we're on elliptical orbit and not a circular one.
Yep. There you go, George. Hopefully that answers it. Thanks for the call. Mark emails to say, was mathematics invented or discovered? Many claim that math is no more than a human construct, while others say it's a fundamental part of the universe's existence. Galileo called it the language of the gods.
Yeah.
I'm not religious, writes Mark, but so I'll call it the language of the universe.
It's a philosophical question, and so this actually goes back to Plato. And there are some very famous mathematicians. Roger Penrose in the UK is an example of someone who would call themselves a Platonist, and they feel that mathematics is there to be discovered. Right, it is a property of the universe, whereas there are other people who think it is a construct that's created by humans to understand the universe. I don't worry about it too much. Because
I hated math.
Well, no, I love math. Math is your friend.
No, it's not my friend.
Yes, it is. It makes really, really hard things easier. That's what it's invented to do, basically. There we go. I said invented. The reason why, I sort of give everyone a sort of an intuitive understanding of why this is an interesting question is because as we've learned more about the universe, we've found that more and more we can describe it with mathematics. And so that has made people think, well, you know, is there just something fundamental in the universe that allows us to use mathematics to describe it, right? But it's a big philosophical debate. Personally, it's not something that I have cared to spend too time worrying about because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter to me. And it doesn't matter to me because I can use mathematics and I'm a physicist. And so that's what I need. It's for me, it's a tool. Right. Whether it's something that we are actually discovering as properties about the universe or whether it is something that we're inventing, I'm honestly, I can't lose sleep over that. I know some people are very concerned about that, but personally, I'm not. So I don't have an answer in is the real answer. But personally, I tend to err towards it more being a human creation. But at the end of the day, yes, there could be properties of the universe that allow us to create those things. And in some sense, that's tautological because everything that we create, the universe has to allow us to be able to create that anyway, because we're constructed from the universe.
Food for thought.
Yeah.
10:39, let's talk about space 2020. We're in the new year here now, and there are a number of space missions that are being touted as, space missions to watch in 2020. Dr. Robin, give us a sense of some of the things that we'll see this year.
Well, the moon, Mars, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on, stuff to the lower orbit as well. I think the thing that probably has received the most attention so far is the Mars 2020 rover. And so that's going to be launched later on during the year, I think.
Is that the one that looks for life or signs of life or something along those lines?
No, it's more of another big life. Saying that so bad, my geologist friends are going to be really angry with me. So it's a big geology experiment, very interesting big geology experiment. And so this is a follow-on to the Curiosity rover. But the thing that they're going to be doing is taking samples, and the goal is to actually go to Mars, extract, pick these samples up, and bring them back.
Oh, really?
Right. Yeah. So everyone sort of says, why can't you just send stuff out there and do the experiments up there? Because the short answer is we invent new experiments down here all the time.
Yeah, imagine when the moon rocks brought, how much did that teach us about the moon, right? Yeah.
Exactly. So having rocks from Mars on the Earth would be an awesome thing. And so this is one of the ideas, is about half a kilogram of rock would be brought back at some point, probably by 2030. So don't, 2030, it's I'm going to be 5 years away from retirement. But anyway, so it's going to be a few years before that happens, but that is the goal. And so Mars 2020 is the follow-on to Curiosity. So we'll have two rovers active on the surface again. And so, well, assuming this all works out nicely, but Curiosity was a really great success. So fingers crossed for this one. There's also going to be a European Space Agency mission to Mars as well.
And a United Arab Emirates mission, it says here. And China also plans a small rover from Mars as well.
Yeah, so I think that of all of those, probably Mars 2020 is the most interesting, but the Rosalind Franklin rover from ESA will be carrying some experiments potentially looking for life. But as I always try to point out to people, there's no single experiment you can do and go, ha-ha, there's life. Yeah. It's really difficult, okay? It's really difficult to do this. And so we know intimately what things that are alive look like to us on the surface of the Earth, but it's another thing to do that out in space and so on. And even the simplest things you can think of can prove to be very easy to fool, to make you think there is life when in fact there isn't. So, but a lot of fun stuff going on Mars over the next year. Returning to the moon, who's going to the moon? So China is going to be doing something interesting there, that they're planning to bring samples back from the moon. And so that will be the Chang'e 5, and that makes them the third nation, or would make them the third nation to bring stuff back from the moon.
Russia and the U.S.
Right. Russia and the U.S. being the other two. China. I think the last one was the Russians in the mid-70s. It was Luna 24, that was it. So that was 76, I think.
That Mars 2020 rover will blast off July 17th. But next month, February, it's a joint mission of NASA and the European Space Agency where they'll be exploring the sun, a solar orbiter launch in February.
Yeah, so the Parker Solar Probe is already up there. That's the thing that's garnering a lot of interest because it's flying closer and closer to the sun. But the sun is so amazing because it's got so much difficult physics. And so the more satellites we put up, the more we learn about the sun, the more we learn this really difficult magnetohydrodynamic processes that go on in the sun. It sounds complicated. Boy, it is.
And this thing's just going to crash right into the sun, if I'm not mistaken, is it not?
Well, why is it called an orbiter if it's going to crash in?
Well, it's going to orbit a bit, and then I think when it's finished with its job, I think it just falls to the sun.
Okay,
I don't think it comes back.
You'd have to deorbit it into the sun because it's going to just keep on going around for a very long time. Okay. Otherwise. So anyway,
here's another interesting space mission. The U.S. Air Force is expected to sometime in 2020 once again launch the mysterious X-37B space plane, known as the Orbital Test Vehicle. The sixth mission of the uncrewed vehicle, which can stay in space for up to a year. One would assume that because the Air Force is involved, that this is a weapon in space?
Well, it's probably not a weapon. It's probably a big camera.
Oh, really?
It's probably a spy
satellite. Spy satellite,
yeah,
okay.
Exactly. So this may well be what they have replaced some of their high-tech, what are they called, the Keystone satellites with. And so the funny thing about this, and I love this, is they do the launch. And for one of them, they said, oh, the launch didn't go very well and we lost this ship, right? And the amateur astronomers were tracking it. They're like, no, they didn't lose it. It's still up there. They just said that. And so this is a game of cat and mouse between the U.S. Air Force and the amateur astronomers. And so they're these amateur astronomers, amateur in name, they're very, very good at what they do in terms of satellite tracking. And so there will be an interesting situation to see what happens where they say, oh, no, that launch failed as well. One of the things you can do is actually just put stuff up there that creates a debris field so you don't know what's going on and it's difficult to track, although we don't think that's a good thing to do because we don't need debris up there. So, I think the X-37 is actually a spy sat. So it has enough fuel to maneuver it around and then come back down. I mean, you can argue why do they feel a need to land it. I don't have a good answer for that, actually, because with the old spy sats, they just used to burn up, right? They had enough fuel on them to basically go up and down, and then eventually they'd run out and burn up in the atmosphere. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, another interesting, and you've mentioned this on a number of occasions, the Starlink, this series of little satellites.
Starlink is, Ken mentioned this as well. So Starlink is going to be this huge constellation of satellites, as it's called. So a huge network of satellites providing global internet. It's annoyed astronomers, and it's annoyed me for that matter, because they've designed the satellites in such a way that they're highly reflective. And so there was a big issue down in Chile when a whole stream of them went over the view of a telescope and basically destroyed the observations from the telescope. And so everyone would say, well, come on, you're just a bunch of astronomers. What about having internet around the world? Isn't that more valuable? I can kind of see that argument, but the point is that they need to actually paint parts of the satellite black to reduce that. You don't want us to spend $1 billion on a telescope and then we can't use a damn thing. That's just crazy, right? So we're trying to do a very noble pursuit of finding out knowledge in the universe, figure out where we came from and so on. And just having a bunch of satellites ruining all of that feels a little bit inappropriate. And so one of the things we've talked about is how are we going to regulate all of this? Because there's no international regulation of this. Like, it's all
no international space treaty or anything along those lines.
So the space treaty controls how we use space, right? It doesn't actually control what launches. Launches are determined essentially by governments, right? And so Starlink applies, or SpaceX applies for a license to create this network of satellites, and then the US deliberates on it. And so they're saying up to 42,000. Let's put this into perspective. Right, there's probably about 6,000 visible stars in a really, really, over the whole sky at a really, really good dark site.
Right? Really, that's it.
42,000 satellites. There would be more satellites in the sky than there would be visible stars.
Wow, that would be a real.
So imagine the situation where you have a little kid going, "Mummy," because mummy's an astronomer, right? What are the things that aren't moving?
Yeah. Right. Interesting. It's called the future. Rob.
Yeah,
it's called the future.
It's really sort of like concerning for astronomers anyway, because we've been used to having this heritage of the sky. This thing when you look up and you go, wow, what's out there?
And we're not going to be able to see that? It's going to block our view of that?
It will be so different. It will be moving constantly, right?
Hard to put your mind into that. 10:47 is the time. He is Dr. Rob Thacker. He's from St. Mary's University. This is Science Files. Bob's on the line. We'll get to you in just a moment. We've got a question from Bobby an email as well. We'll ask that as well. And if you've got a question, give us a call, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Back with more Science Files in just a moment. 10:50 on a Monday morning with Dr. Rob and Science Files. And well, let's go to the phones and hear what Bob's got to say this morning. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, Rick. Good morning, Dr. Rob.
Hi, Bob.
Happy New Year to you both.
And you.
Thank you so much. The way I understand dying stars is that they either nova or supernova, like the one in Orion's belt. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay, cool. So there would be a flash of light. We would be able to record a nova?
Yeah, if you're looking in the right place, absolutely, for sure, yep.
Okay. There's been I read an article about 2 or 3 weeks ago about disappearing stars without supernova or a nova. Is that possible?
I mean, things can go dim, certainly, but you usually expect some kind of... So as the star dies... So the reason why this isn't simple is because depending upon the mass of the star, they die in different ways. So if they're more than 5-6 times the mass of the sun, then they die in the supernovae. If they're smaller than that, they end up forming, we expect, a white dwarf star. And then as that's actually being created, there will be a release of the gas off the giant stage of the star, creating what's called a planetary nebula. So those things, I don't know enough about the details of the light curves, to be honest, to be actually, I have colleagues who would know actually in my department, but I don't know off the top of my head. But that would essentially mean that the dimming just isn't bright enough for us to detect any sudden increases in output. But
This is not a dimming. The article suggested that these things just disappeared. And apparently there's hundreds of them.
Okay, off the top of my head, I don't know, because that doesn't make sense to me.
No, it didn't make sense to me either. That's why I want to ask the question. And the article goes on about the creation of antimatter and that sort of thing. I found it interesting, but I don't know if I believe it. And yes, math is our friend. I like math a lot. It has improved my chess game, ironically.
Right.
Good, good for you. Yeah.
I mean,
it only made me buy more calculators.
But that's arithmetic. That's not necessarily math. Math does a lot more things.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's like a big puzzle, a mathematical puzzle to me. But anyway, well, thank you very much for the information.
No problem.
I like to see other perspectives on what's going on in the stellar world.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a link, you can always email it to Rick, and then we can look at it in detail.
Sure enough.
Okay, cool.
Thanks, Bob.
Yep.
Bye-bye. Another Bob. Bobby emails, and please ask Dr. Rob, is it possible, or sorry, no, he says, if it is possible to manipulate the weather over Australia to help with the fires like they've done in China with cannons full of salt and minerals. He says they made it rain before the Beijing Olympics to make sure it didn't rain during the event. So is it possible that they could try to do something similar in Australia?
I'm going to say no. The logic of this is to create rain, you need to have what's called nucleation sites within the rain cloud. And so one of the things you can do is you can shoot up into the rain cloud, silver iodide, and that will actually create these little nucleation points, and then it will start raining. So you can do that on small scales, but to do that on the size of what we're talking about, you literally wouldn't be able to do it. It's just too big.
They had a little rain in Australia yesterday, I believe, but not enough to really...
Well, so the pyrocumulonimbus probably will bring some rain, but it will also probably create some more lightning strikes.
I've been watching some news coverage in the States about these ring cameras, they're called here, these new doorbells, with the video cameras. And people are now hacking into them.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw one of the videos, there's a young girl, I don't know, she could have been more than 7-8 years old in her bedroom.
And the hacker was talking to her.
And the hacker's talking to her through this device. And she's standing there, and all of a sudden she says, "Mommy!"
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's going on
here? Because the hacker said, "It's Santa."
That's right. He says, "I'm your best friend, Santa Claus." Yeah. So how are they doing this, Dr. Rob? And as I understand it, the company that makes these ringtones says that it's not their fault.
No, so the deal is, like, when you log into something, you're used to having a password, right?
Yeah.
Right. So if you have a password that you use a lot on many different sites, and one of those sites gets hacked, then people have your login and your password. And so then they can go around and they can literally share all of these files with other hackers and create a situation in which you better change your password or you're vulnerable.
And change them on a regular basis, right?
So there is a way around this. And so one of the good parts of security that we have now is we have our own personal cell phone, right? And so if you set things up such that when you log in, you then get a code to your cell phone, no one else has your cell phone, right? Now, there could be a very sophisticated redirect, but that's really high tech. That's very difficult for an individual hacker to do. And so if you have a password and then you have a code on your phone that you use, that's called two-factor authentication.
And that's what the company is saying is required.
That's what you should do on anything that you use for security, right? If you're putting cameras into your house for security, then you should have two-factor authentication on that system, period. And so I am a little bit concerned that they put this camera in their child's room. I find that quite disturbing, right? But nonetheless, it was put in for security and so on. So, if you do buy these technologies, make sure you understand what two-factor authentication is. It's good. It works well. It's not absolutely perfect. No security system is. But it's a heck of a lot better than using a password that someone's cracked somewhere. Yeah.
And who are these people? I mean, obviously with time on their hands, are sitting there hacking into these devices.
Hackers come in many different shapes and forms. There are some who are just out there to create a little bit of havoc and have some fun. They're called script kiddies. And then there are more serious people who really want to cause damage, really want to make money off it. And those are, in many cases, associated with organized crime as well. So that's more problematic. In this case, I'm not entirely sure. I think it was just someone who was targeting a particular family just for the heck of it. There are, in fact, for the Ring cameras, apps that you can buy that have a whole bunch of passwords that will actually try logging into people's systems. And so if you've had your password cracked, you got to change it. You've got no choice.
And good advice indeed. And if
I'll admit my password was cracked because I used Adobe products many years ago.
Yeah.
And the Adobe database was hacked. And now I get spam emails saying, we have your password and we're logging into all your systems. But of course, because I knew it got hacked, I changed my passwords.
Yeah.
So even when someone says, this is your password, I know you, I'm going to ruin your life. I go, haha, no, you're not.
Technology. Marvelous. Yeah. Dr. Rob, a pleasure to see you again as we start the new year here. And thank you for dropping by. And
absolute pleasure. Great questions as well.
Yes. Joe, indeed. We'll see you next Monday. Dr. Rob Thacker is with us here every Monday at this time for Science Files. It is now 2 minutes before 11 o'clock. We're going to break here for a news update. Then it's your turn. We've got our first open hour of the week coming up next hour. We call it Manic Monday. Anything goes between 11 and 12, and our phone lines await your calls now at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll take your calls after the news, and the news is coming up next.